The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'd like to continue on the theme of what the Buddha had to say about our relationships with other people, how to engage in our practice in relationship. And one of the main teachings in this area is the teachings on ethics. The ethical guidelines in the Buddha's teachings aren't really what I would consider moralistic. They're more practical guidelines, practical suggestions about ways to behave, ways to relate that don't lead to suffering, either for ourselves or for other people. So the basis, the true basis of ethics in the Buddhist tradition is non-harming. So looking at our behavior in our relationships, our orientation in our relationships, and looking at our actions, our speech and our thoughts, and seeing whether the way that we engage in those things creates harm. It's also about the ethical practices are also about cultivating clarity of mind and clarity of intention. When we start paying attention to our actions and whether they cause harm or suffering for ourselves or others, we quickly start to see that when we engage in behaviors that harm other people or harm ourselves, that there's a little bit of cloudiness or agitation that comes into our minds. So the agitation obscures the clarity of mind. So for instance, suppose you have a situation where you feel like you need to not quite tell the truth to a particular friend about some situation. And then it might start to ruminate in your mind that you had told this lie to this friend, and you might think, wow, I know that person knows this other person, and I'd better make sure that this other person knows that what I've told that person so that they don't mess me up here. You know, so the mind starts to plan and to orient around the action that was not so skillful. So it obscures a clarity of mind. Behaving in ways that harm other people obscures a clarity of mind. And as we begin to look at our behavior, look at our actions towards other people, this is another key point, I think, in the Buddhist understanding of ethics, is that as we start to look at how we relate to other people and find ways to engage that are skillful in relationship to other people, we find it supports ourselves as well as other people. We in cultivating harmlessness towards other people, we also are cultivating harmlessness to ourselves. There's in fact a teaching on this in the suttas. It's a kind of an analogy the Buddha gives about acrobats performing. And one of the acrobats, the younger acrobat, is needing to climb up onto the shoulders, onto a bamboo pole of the older acrobat. And the older acrobat says to him, if you look out for me and I look out for you, then we'll be safe. We'll be able to come down from the bamboo pole safely. And the younger acrobat says, no, I don't think that's it. I think I need to look out for myself, and you need to look out for yourself, and in that way we'll come down safely. And the Buddha said that the younger acrobat was correct, that when we look out for ourselves, we look out for others. And he points out that also in looking out for others, we look out for ourselves. So the cultivation of our mindfulness practice is looking out for ourselves. And it supports looking out for others in that it also ends up cultivating qualities of kindness, of generosity, of patience, of all kinds of qualities that support a connection and a relationship of non-harming. So we begin to see that this exploration of what supports non-harming, we start to see things in terms of what's skillful and unskillful, rather than in terms of right and wrong. So the teachings, the ethical guidelines in the Buddhist tradition aren't so much about right and wrong. They're more about practical, skillful means to lead us away from suffering towards happiness. One of my favorite teachings on non-harming in the Buddhist tradition is a teaching that the Buddha gives to his son. And I know that Gil did a series on ethics not long ago here, so he might have mentioned this teaching, but I'm going to just review it and talk a little bit about my perspective about this teaching that he gave to his son. So the teaching, it's a very simple teaching. He gave it to his 7-year-old son, so it's a teaching that a child can understand. But it is also very challenging. When I first read this, I thought, wow, he expected his 7-year-old son to do this? I don't know if I can do this. He basically tells his son that for any action of body, before he does the action, he should reflect on whether it will cause harm to anybody, himself or others or both. And if he sees in that reflection before doing an action that it's going to cause harm, he should not do it. And he goes on to say, but if you see that it is not going to cause harm, then go ahead and do it. Then he goes on to say, but you don't stop there. While you're doing the action, while you're in the middle of doing the action, if you see that it is causing harm while you're doing it, to yourself, to others, or to both, you should stop. If you see that it's not causing harm, you can continue. And he doesn't even stop there. He says, after the action has finished, you should reflect back and think, did it cause harm to self, to others, or to both? And if it did, you should essentially, what does he say? He says, the light's a little low. Well, I'll paraphrase. He said, you should confess your action to a friend in the holy life and undertake restraint for the future. And he not only talks about this with respect to actions of body, he says, before you speak, while you're speaking, after you're speaking, check. And before any action of mind, check. That's pretty impressive for a 7-year-old, I think, to take this on as a practice. So there's a few aspects of this teaching that I like to highlight, to reflect on. And one is this quality of reflection. He, in fact, begins the sutta by asking his son what a mirror is for. And his son says, well, it's for reflection. And the Buddha says, well, in the same way, we should reflect on our actions before, during, after. So there's this aspect of reflecting. So reflecting on our experience essentially allows us to learn from our experience. It's the basics of learning from what has happened, you know, taking in what's going on and looking at the consequences and learning from the consequences. Avoiding consequences that look unskillful or unhelpful or harmful to our relationships. So in this sense, we can begin to become our own teacher. This teaching on non-harming is the beginning of seeing what is skillful and what is unskillful. It also, I feel, is the beginning of training in compassion, because we start to contemplate or to think about, is this going to harm somebody else? And we put ourselves in their shoes, thinking about, is this action going to harm someone else? And that's the movement of compassion, to exchange, essentially exchange self for other. Will this cause the other person harm? Would I want this done to me? That's the movement or the beginning of looking at a relationship of compassion with other people. And I'll talk much more about this aspect of compassion next week. Another part of this sutta that I like to highlight comes in the time when we're looking back on our actions. So there's a reviewing that goes on, a looking back at what have we done and what were the consequences of that action. So as we do this, we may look at our intention, why we chose to do something. And if we have seen that there was harm done, we can look at our intention and say, well, was our intention an intention of harm? And if there was not an intention of harm, that's a supportive thing for us to recognize. But we can't really stop there. Even if we did not have an intention of harming someone, if there was some harm done, we need to think about, even if it wasn't our intention, think about what were the conditions that led to that harm, and is there any way I could have prevented that? Or is there something that I added to the situation that did contribute to harm, even unknowingly, in the time? This is, again, a way we can learn from our experience. There was an example of this. I thought a very interesting and poignant example of this in This American Life, the NPR show that is. I saw this one on television in the televised version of This American Life. And this was the story was about a group of performance artists called Improv Everywhere, and they did these kind of interesting, bizarre activities in cities. So, for instance, there are a couple of examples. Like one time, they call them actors or agents. I think they call them agents. The agents all get together to plan this activity and kind of spring it on the city. So one time they all got together and planned this birthday party in a subway car. You know, that they would celebrate a birthday party in the subway car, and they handed out balloons and, you know, all these things to all the people in the subway car and had them all singing happy birthday, and so that kind of a thing. And another one was they had these kind of menacing looking people dressed in black lining up in the windows of the Whole Foods restaurant. You know, on the city street, you see all these people walking by, and you start to see these people gathering in the Whole Foods restaurant. And you look up, it's like, well, what's going on? And they all start to do jumping jacks. So this is some of the kind of art that they do. Well, there was one particular art that they chose to do. The art, or the name of this one, was called The Best Gig Ever. And it was directed to a small rock band called the Ghosts of Pasha. And they were this little tiny little rock band. They didn't have much exposure in New York City. And they had this gig in New York City. And the Improv Everywhere found out about this gig and decided they were going to give them the best gig ever. So they got a whole bunch of these agents to learn all the songs of the Ghost of Pasha and to appear at this gig and really be into their music. So that they, you know, they really got a sense of having this overwhelming feeling of being loved, essentially. And I think that might have been the motivation, you know, really to give these people a great performance experience. And, you know, apparently, it was a pretty small gig, and apparently, if the agents had not shown up, about two people would have shown up. So, you know, they were playing, and the agents were, like, singing along and, like, you know, swaying to their favorites and just really getting into the music. And the two people in the band are, you know, they're kind of taken aback. You know, they didn't quite expect this kind of reception. But, you know, they're having a great time, and it was a great evening for everybody. And at the end of the evening, everybody kind of went away. And the band went back to their home, kind of wondering, wow, that was kind of amazing, but not really understanding where it had come from or why it had happened. And a few months later, I think, some of their friends read on the internet of Improv Everywhere about this gig, that they had essentially created this performance for this band. And this band, the two people, they were kind of devastated. Because, you know, partly because it was a lie, partly because there seemed to be then this entire, you know, it became a huge joke in the internet community. You know, people started listening to the Ghosts of Pasha and blogging about how horrible they were. And, you know, the band was kind of, it really was a hard, very difficult, painful thing for them. For them. And in discussing, you know, Ira Glass was talking with the main leader of Improv Everywhere, and he said, well, our intention was good, but we can't stop there. I think we have to look at what is it that made it painful. And I was curious about this, you know, it's kind of like, well, what's the difference between the situations of a birthday party in a subway car, or people gathering at Whole Foods. And I think the difference was just that it was targeted to specific individuals. You know, and it struck me that that should be a kind of reflection that they would use, not just the intention, but what is it about this particular situation that caused suffering? And maybe not do that particular kind of targeted performance art. And stick to the general public. Whoever happens to be walking by Whole Foods is the target. It's not a specific individual. So this is a kind of reflection to engage in. A deep and serious looking at our behavior and how it impacts other people. So this reviewing that we do, we have to do it in a very non-guilt-forming way. I think, you know, we have this habit of beating ourselves up in this culture. When we've done something to hurt somebody, we really have a tendency to tell ourselves we're a bad person for having done that. And that is not such a skillful way of using this reviewing. It's more helpful to... the point is not to make ourselves feel guilty, but to look honestly at the situation and what we could have changed. There's a difference between guilt and remorse. Guilt has this feeling of, you know, flogging ourselves, telling ourselves we're a bad person. And remorse is looking honestly at the situation and saying, yes, I did something that caused harm. What can I do? What can I change? How can I not involve myself in that kind of action again? So in the final part that I paraphrased of this, in the part where you look back and see that it has caused harm, the Buddha recommends confessing to a friend, a spiritual friend, and undertaking restraint. So those are two pieces that we can look at when we do something. There are ways to help clear the feeling of regret and the feeling of guilt. In a way, if we have a feeling of guilt, if we make some kind of action, take some kind of action, that can help to clear some of that feeling. There's some additional pieces, though, that the Buddha doesn't recommend, that I mean, he doesn't include in the sutta. I don't know whether he doesn't recommend them, but he doesn't include them, and I'd like to mention them because I think there are some other pieces that can help us if we have harmed someone. And one of those is making amends. Going to the person in some way and apologizing or making reparation in some way. This can be very healing not only for the relationship, but also for our own hearts. Sometimes it's not possible to make amends. The person has died. The person that we have harmed has died. In this kind of situation, it can sometimes be helpful to make some kind of a ritual to clear or somehow express your regret, your remorse to the universe, essentially. And there's a story about this that Jack Kornfield tells that I'll share with you. It's about a man who came onto a meditation retreat with Jack, and he was having a lot of difficulty sitting in the silence. And at some point, he realized that there was a lot of the difficulty he was having was related to some experiences he had in his childhood. And he tells this story. Bruce had grown up on a cattle ranch just outside a small town, Texas town. And somehow when folks in town had dogs they couldn't take care of, they would dump them on the ranch. His father insisted in Bruce be the one to finish off these useless dogs, which meant to shoot them. Between the ages of 8 and 14, he had been forced to shoot about 16 different dogs. He sobbed as he told the story. And Jack sat with him, working with the emotions as this story came out, but also during this interview suggested he create a ritual to express something about this experience, a healing ritual. And this was something that this young man felt a connection with, so he decided to do that. Over the next few days, he chose a hillside site near the retreat center and carefully formed a circle of 16 stones, one for each of the dogs that weighed so heavily on his conscience. Then one evening at dusk, we headed up to the hill together. The stars were becoming visible. Bruce showed me one of the largest stones was oriented north toward Sirius, the dog star, in honor of the dog's undying spirits. At the base of each stone, he'd placed a written prayer of atonement. And then in the center, he'd placed a small stone next to one of the largest. This, he told me through his tears, was the puppy of a dying mother who had tried to shield her even in the last moments after he had shot her. Those were the last dogs he had killed. We meditated in the evening stillness. He bowed, lit candles, offered prayers, and spoke to these dogs about what his heart had learned and how their spirits would teach him for the rest of his days. But Bruce was not yet free. He felt the dogs wanted something from him. He wanted to make atonement. Bruce decided to pledge $5,000 for animal welfare and to always keep a dog and to work half a day each month in the nearby animal shelter for 10 years. This he felt would be a labor of love. I saw Bruce 6 months later. He told me that his healing work was as challenging as ever, but he felt better. I could see it. His whole spirit seems to have lightened, his body relaxed. So ritual can be a very powerful way to move through a deep regret. Another practice that's very supportive and helpful when we've harmed someone is forgiveness practice towards ourselves. And this practice is useful not only towards ourselves, but if somebody has harmed us, if we have harmed ourselves, there are different aspects to this forgiveness practice. And I'm just going to share it with you because it's a very simple practice. It's basically three phrases. And depending on the situation of whether you're directing a forgiveness to yourself for harming yourself, or directing forgiveness to someone else for harming you, or asking for forgiveness from someone who you have harmed. So, in the first case, if you bring to mind, and this is, if you're doing this as a practice, it's typically done in this order, to start with bringing to mind someone you have harmed. And there's a phrase. The phrase is, for any harm that I have caused you, intentionally or unintentionally, I ask for your forgiveness. And this asking for forgiveness is another way of atoning. Because it really indicates a way in which we see how we have created harm and wish to not have that harm stand in the way of the relationship. The second thing is bringing to mind a way in which you might have harmed yourself. And the phrase is, for any harm that I have caused myself, intentionally or unintentionally, I forgive myself. The third one is usually the hardest, forgiving someone who has harmed us. The phrase is, the traditional phrase is, for any harm that you have caused me, intentionally or unintentionally, I freely forgive you. And sometimes this phrase seems like it's not necessarily true. That saying this phrase maybe borders on almost false speech, because we can't really feel like we're forgiving the person. That there are times when something has happened so deeply to wound us that it's very, very difficult to express that forgiveness, even if we're just expressing it internally to ourselves. And this is a kind of an internal meditation practice, what I've suggested here. So there are some alternative phrases to use for this last one. So you could say, I forgive you to the extent that I am able. Or you might, if that's not even possible, say, I wish that I may someday be able to forgive you. Just to express that intention towards opening the heart at some point, even if you don't feel that you can do it now. Another training on non-harming. I like the training that he gives to his son, the training just on looking at whether things are causing harm, because it brings things back to the basics. It brings things back to the Four Noble Truths. Is this causing suffering? And how can I behave such that it doesn't cause suffering? So it really brings things back to the basics. But there's some more specific teachings in the Buddhist tradition around non-harming. And this is the teachings on the precepts or training rules. And the five precepts that we typically look at for lay people are refraining from killing, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. Now again, these sound a lot like thou shalt not. They have that flavor. But the way that they're worked with in this tradition is not, again, it's not so moralistic. It's much more practical suggestions that the Buddha says, look, if you engage in these behaviors, it's going to cause somebody suffering. So see if you can avoid them. So I like to look at them not so much as commandments to just simply blindly follow, but rather as ways to engage with mindfulness with my actions. If I see some action like this getting ready to happen, like killing a mosquito or just, you know, wiping ants down off my counter with soap, you know, wait a minute, this is getting ready to kill living beings. What's going on? Looking at with mindfulness, using them almost as mindfulness bells, as reminders to wake up. Wait a minute, this is going to cause harm. Look at what's going on. So exploring our hearts and minds, when we feel this pull, when we feel this pull to do something that would break one of these precepts. So this practice of working with ethics helps to cultivate our mindfulness around what is skillful and what is unskillful. So it's a wisdom cultivation. On Sundays, I'm talking about wisdom, and one of the key definitions of wisdom in the Buddhist teachings is knowing the difference between skillful and unskillful with respect to causing harm, with respect to suffering. Something is unskillful if it leads us into suffering, if it leads us towards dukkha. Something is skillful if it leads us away from dukkha. As we commit to acting ethically in the world, there's a couple of really beautiful benefits. And they reflect an inner and outer essentially gifts that we give ourselves and others. We give ourselves, when we act ethically, what the Buddha calls the bliss of blamelessness. That we have the bliss of knowing we have not intentionally caused harm. And that's a very happy-producing place to be. It's, you know, I think most of us have the experience of what it feels like to be in that place of regret for having harmed someone. It's not so blissful. And the gift we give others in the ethical behavior is the gift of fearlessness, because beings do not need to be afraid around us. They have the confidence, we give them the gift of confidence that we will not harm them. So essentially, this ethical training cultivates an inner relationship and an outer relationship. Another place this inner and outer relationship, not so much relationship to the world, but there's relationship, another place of inner and outer in the ethical training is looking at the relationship between the inner workings of our mind and the manifestation in behavior. There's a really tight link, a coupling between what goes on in our minds and what happens in our actions. And most of us understand this. I mean, we all know that when we've got things going on in our mind, it can kind of erupt in our behavior. It's, for example, if we're angry, often we can speak in an angry way, or we can lash out at somebody. So that anger in our mind, we're very familiar with that, you know, the anger in our mind producing behavior that results in that angry behavior, essentially. But this interrelationship goes both directions. So not only does the way our mind works, you know, what's happening in our minds impact our behavior, our behavior impacts our minds. There's like a rebound effect. Behaving in a certain way can have a rebound effect on our minds. And we don't seem to, you know, when I think about this relationship, I know that for myself, there's initially kind of a feeling of distrust of this direction of the relationship. It's like in this culture, in the way that we've got this culture of being true to how we're feeling, you know. And if I'm angry and I don't allow myself to be able to express it, it means that I'm suppressing the anger. And that's not good. So we have this, I think, belief a little bit more that we should allow our emotions to come out in our behavior. And we don't have as much trust on a way of restraining behavior as a way of supporting a calming and settling of the mind. So I'll talk a little bit about how this works, at least my understanding about how it works. And there's a skillful way to do it and perhaps a not so skillful way to do it. So if we behave peacefully, honestly, compassionately, even if we're not feeling that way, it begins to cultivate those feelings inwardly. But we have to be, and this is where the key is, this is how it will work. We can't delude ourselves into thinking that we are, because we're behaving that way, that we are feeling that way. We can't like cover over the feelings that we're having. If we're not feeling generous, but we want to cultivate generosity, so we're offering a gift, we can't deny that we're not feeling generous. But we have to engage in the activity of giving with the intention of cultivating that quality of generosity inside. So that the place where mind and body meet is this mental factor of intention. And if we engage in a behavior, even if we don't feel generosity, if we behave in the way of giving with the intention of cultivating generosity, it will begin to have a rebound effect on our minds. Sometimes it can even have a rebound effect if we're not even thinking about cultivating it, but just if we're just trying to be non-reactive to a situation. So I had this experience. I don't know if I can tell this story. Maybe not. Or maybe I will. I'll tell this story, and this will then we'll end. A situation where I was really working with not killing beings, not killing living beings, and I was having major ant infestations in my house. So I started working with this by, you know, trying to find a way to get the ants out of the kitchen without killing them. And my way to do this was I started by getting some soap on a sponge and corralling the ants. You know, I put this big ring of soap around the ants, and then I'd start working them back to the place where they came in from. This took a long time. I started getting a little impatient with the ants, and so at some point I took a piece of paper and started scooping up the ants that were at the end of the corral and depositing them back by the place where I saw them coming in. and edging them back a little bit more. And at some point in this process, I saw one of the ants at near the hole while I was like depositing some of the ants back. I saw one ant rise up on its back legs and like start scanning the environment like a radar, like this. And in that moment, I connected with a living being. It's like, wow, you know, there's alarm going on here. And there was a connection. And I felt compassion for these ants. And it's interesting because the Buddhist teachings tell us that not killing cultivates compassion. And that's what I noticed. That just this act of trying not to kill the ants, then there was this connection. It really showed me how that worked. So there are a lot of beautiful qualities cultivated as we engage in this practice of non-harming. I've mentioned several already. Wisdom gets cultivated, this quality of beginning to understand what leads us away from harming, what's skillful, what's unskillful. Mindfulness is cultivated because we need to be mindful in order to be aware of how our behavior is impacting others. Effort to engage our mindfulness in this skillful way. Perhaps renunciation is cultivated as we let go of behaviors we would otherwise engage in. Patience is cultivated. Virtue, resolve, generosity, and truthfulness. All of these beautiful qualities are cultivated as we engage in this practice of non-harming. And these beautiful qualities, generosity, patience, they support the relationship that we have with all beings on the planet. So may you include this aspect of non-harming in your relationships, and particularly in your daily activities with engaging with other people. Thank you for your attention.